Oh, hey, I'm glad you're here. I've touched on it before, but growing up in a video store, there was one area that wasn't very interesting to me. Oddly, it was the kids' area. And don't get me wrong, the Black Cauldron, terrifying. But the Wuzzles, Bumbleeye and VHS, or Foozlebop Cruisin' for a Foozin' weren't exactly calling my name. And don't even get me started on GoBots' Battle for the Rock Lords. I liked cartoons, of course. And if you do, be sure and check out the Spirited Away episode with my daughter as the guest. But I especially liked the cartoons when they were spotted outside of the kid zone. Fire and Ice was probably the first I saw that I realized something different was happening, followed by Lord of the Rings, utterly terrifying. But I think it was a sleepover at a friend's house where we stumbled across BC Rock, a very adult cartoon, and I didn't realize that there was such a thing as adult animation. I certainly didn't know that there were adult comic books. My mind was blown. Fritz the Cat was probably next. This type of animation seemed rebellious. There was something subversive and otherworldly. I mean, watching cats smoke pot and fornicate will have that effect. I've always had respect for animators, illustrators, and artists. Which brings me to this episode. The film is Cool World, the guest is in animation, and this is VHS. Hello, and welcome to VHS, the podcast where each episode is about a film and the guest has the profession portrayed in the film. I'm your host, Dirk Marshall, and today I'm joined by Mick Cassidy, who is an animator, character designer, and artist. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
People can find more about you on your website, blackmako.carbonmade.com, is that right?
Yeah, blackmako.com, that'll take you to the Carbon Made. I need to update that one.
Oh, yeah. I was just checking it out yesterday. And they can see more of your artwork at metalmongrel.bigcartel.com.
Yeah. And metalmongrel on Instagram. That's just some joke.
I didn't know about that one. That's good to know. So, yeah, it's actually two of your, prints that are on the Metal Mongrel. Captive of the Howl. I'm getting that one for my daughter. I was just looking at it last night. And I'm still deciding if I want Mother Dirt or Hate Train, but both of them are awesome.
Okay, well, I will speed them your way.
Okay, great. Currently, you're employed at Family Guy, and you do character design, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
And how does that work? Does someone just go Lisa Kudrow and you have to draw Lisa Kudrow, or...?
Pretty much. The script is written, and somebody goes through the script and decides what we need for each new episode. So it's a case of figuring out what we've already done, what we need that's new. And then, as the title says, we'll design them, depending on what the script calls for.
Sure. And were you, did you start the same year they started?
No. Family Guy has been canceled twice.
Right.
So, I've been with it since the resurrection in 2004.
Okay.
It was a pretty unlikely situation where a show gets canceled and then finds life after death. And then suddenly the studio realizes, oh, shit, there's an audience for this. So they go crawling back to Seth MacFarlane and, hey, we were thinking about putting your show back on the air, right? That stuff doesn't happen often in Hollywood, so.
Right. Well, and I imagine a show like Family Guy is really interesting for you because of the rapid fire jokes. There's probably so many new characters you're designing.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. I mean, you look at a show like it and you just think, this thing must draw itself. But honestly, every episode usually has a hefty amount of new designs to be done. And there's four character designers on the show. So, and we're never short of work. So it's always something to be done.
Well, and you've also worked on a crazy pedigree of films like Land Before Time, The Little Mermaid, All Dogs Go to Heaven, Thumbelina, The Goofy Movie, Beauty and the Beast, Eight Crazy Nights, and Rockadoodle, to name a few.
Well, a few of those I haven't worked on, but I can tell you why it came up.
Is that because there's another Mick Cassidy?
It's even weirder than that. There's an Australian girl I used to work with called Mickey Cassidy. And on our IMDb pages, the titles tend to jump across.
Oh, that's so funny, because some of them do say, like, there's three different names in there. For
yeah,
you.
That's right.
So which ones did you not work on?
I didn't work on any of the good ones. So,
okay. So I don't know which ones are the good ones anymore.
Yeah, well, it's a thing. I worked on the Bluth movies.
Yes.
And Before Time, All Dogs Go to Heaven, Rockadoodle, Thumbelina, all the way through to Anastasia, wasted a year of my life in Phoenix, Arizona. I've done some work for Disney, but never directly in their feature animation department.
Okay. That's great, because I don't want to talk about the Disney stuff, because I grew up in a video store and we had The Secret of Nim and some of the other Bluth classics, and I wore those things out. Like, I love the Don Bluth films, especially because he did Dragon Slayer with Dirk the Daring, you know, the video game.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so, and being named Dirk, I had to like anything named Dirk, which there wasn't a lot of. I had,
you know, like, they're doing a live-action version of it now.
That's right here.
And Ryan Reynolds is going to play Dirk, which is a pretty perfect piece of casting.
Yeah, that could be really... I'm interested to see what they make the villain look like.
That's yeah. Cool. I mean, the only disappointing thing, of course, is that it's live-action. It's not going to be animated, so...
Well, and that video game was just hell on earth. I don't know if you ever played it, but it was like, it was animated, and then something would flash on the screen and you'd have to move the joystick in one of those directions to continue the animation or you'd die. So it was like, you played for like 30 seconds at a time. It was just, it's impossible.
I mean, did anyone ever really play it?
I tried, but only because the arcade next to my dad's video store had it. But other than that, no, I don't think so. But you can watch the whole animated, like all the scenes cut together on YouTube now. So
yeah, it was cool working at Bluth, because I loved Secret of Nim when I saw it, when it came out as well. And I was familiar with Dragon's Lair and Space Ace. So yeah. it was kind of a nice return that he moved to Dublin and started hiring people. So I was fucking stoked, man. I mean, I was 16 years old, had a year left in high school, and I skipped out. Haven't looked back. That was 1987. That was 32 years ago this summer. 33 years.
That's so cool. So, you weren't even out of high school.
I had a year left in school, and I was just doing shit. I hated school. I just couldn't handle it. And my parents were getting called down to the school every week because I was just wrecking the neighborhood. Yeah. I was always in trouble. And the principal essentially just said, look, he's got a chance to work here. My neighbor, I had a neighbor who was working at the Bluth studio, and he suggested to my mom, like, hey, let's bring some mix artwork in. Let's have someone look at it and see. And they offered me a job. And, you know, my folks were, I think, a little reluctant for me to skip school. But the principal of the school essentially said, look, let's let him go for a year. And if it works, great. And if it doesn't work, you can come back and finish.
Oh, yeah. So you're going back this year? No. That's,
yeah.
That's awesome. The reason that I'm joined by Mick Cassidy today is because we're brought together by the film Cool World. Was this a first-time watch for you?
It was the first time sitting all the way through it for me. Yeah.
I saw it in the theater, and I can tell you honestly that I had zero memories of this movie. and it all came flooding back, unfortunately, when I started it. I would say I chose this for a specific reason, but that's not true. It's very difficult to find movies about animators. Comic strip artists, there's no problem, you know, American Splendor, Monkey Bone, Chasing Amy, Arts and Models. But this was kind of it for us to have this conversation. So we both endured it, shall we say.
Yeah, man, I sat through some stinkers in my time, but man, that was hard work.
It's real rough. And I, you know, I don't like to talk shit about people's things they create and whatnot, but it really got to work, this movie. first, to put it in context, the director is Ralph Bakshi. Started as an animator on the Heckle and Jekyll show. Super prolific. Most notably directed Fritz the Cat in 72, Heavy Traffic 73, Coonskin 75, Wizards in 77, Lord of the Rings in 78, which messed up a generation. American Pop in 81, Hey Good Looking in 82, Fire and Ice, which I was obsessed with in 83. He did an animated sequence in Cannibal Run 2, and then Cool World. And then didn't do another animated feature after that. So this kind of ruined it.
Yeah.
I loved the early Bakshi stuff. Like, it was, he was so like subversive and controversial, and it just felt grimy and forbidden. Like, once I found one, I was like, I gotta find pretty much everything. I don't know if you had any kind of experience with his canon of film.
I mean, I knew Wizards, I knew Lord of the Rings, like yourself. I mean, there was no escaping the Lord of the Rings adaptation in the late 70s. Working in the animation community, Bakshi had quite the reputation. I mean, like you say, he was subversive. And, you know, there's something kind of appealing about the idea of trying to do an adult version of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which I think was his intention with Cool World. And, you know, that's cool. Animation really gets the short end of the stick in the US, I think, as a medium. It's always treated as a kid's medium. You can only tell kid stories with it. And there's just other parts of the world where animation translates to every genre and every age. So it's good that he was there trying to do it. It's just such a shame that it had to be in this form.
Yeah, and we'll get to why, unfortunately, it is this form. The cinematographer is John A. Alonso, who did Vanishing Point, Chinatown, Overboard, and Steel Magnolias. Like, that's crazy to also be responsible for Cool World. The editor, we have two editors, which is kind of an uh-oh. The first one, Steve Merkovich, did Con Air, Big Trouble in Little China, Prince of Darkness, Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, TMNT 2, Secret of the Ooze. The other editor, Anna Maria DeSanto, makes a little more sense here by mostly Cinemax late night films like Playtime, Sacred Cargo, and Fatal Passion.
Oh, boy.
Cool World fits right in there with those. And she also did Three Ninjas High Noon at Mega Mountain, which I didn't see that one. Our character animator is Paul Bolger, I believe, who did worked on Land Before Time, Rockadoodle, All Dogs Go to Heaven, three that you've worked on.
Yeah, I worked with Paul, and to tell you more, I spoke to Paul this morning.
Oh,
because,
did you?
I told him I was going to be doing this podcast, and you know, it was pretty funny. He had some fun stories to tell, mostly about Bakshi, and he was quite the personality, I think. Big imposing personality, and most of these guys that run out and run their own studios and stuff, they're usually pretty big personalities. I think they kind of have to be when you're outside the whole studio environment. Bluth was the same.
I think I just drawn to those outsiders. Like, it always was what was going to happen. Same thing with like music and stuff. Like, you hear the more mainstream things and you're like, this just isn't striking a chord, and then you start digging down dirty old rabbit holes and find like the odds and ends, and you're like, yeah, this is what I want, you know. One of the things that it said for Paul Bolger on Land Before Time, it said rough animation in betweener. What does that title mean?
All right, well, now we're going down a rabbit hole.
I'll
keep this entertaining. In any animation studio, from Family Guy, which is, you know, a TV show, so it's a very different setup than feature animation, which is what Land Before Time would have been. It's very compartmentalized. Everybody has one very specific job. So a rough in-betweener would essentially, you would start out with an animator who'll do all the key poses. He'll do the acting. He'll time out the drawings. Mm-hmm. What he wants the action to do and how fast he wants to do it, but he'll leave gaps between the drawings. So for example, if he's drawing a character lifting a cup of tea, he'll draw one pose of a character with the cup on the table and one pose with the cup at the character's mouth.
Got
and
it.
It's the in-betweener's job to fill in those drawings, and there'll be a timing chart that'll be at the side of the drawing that'll essentially tell you how many drawings he wants between the two poses, which will depend on how fast or how slow he wants that action to happen.
Got it. That makes total sense. So it's like it's a way to move things along faster.
Yeah, and it's kind of an entry-level job too. That's kind of how I got in there too. So gradually you learn more and more as you're going, and then they give you more and more posing of your own to do as you go along. So
that makes sense. The actors we have here, we got Kim Basinger or Basinger, depending on how you say it. She was in Never Say Never Again, 9.5 Weeks, My Stepmom's an Alien, Batman, Cool World, LA Confidential, just to name a few. Then we got Gabriel Byrne. I don't understand why he's in this movie, but we got The Keep in 83, Gothic in 86, Miller's Crossing in 89, Cool World, 92, Point of No Return. And in 95, he's in both Dead Man and Usual Suspects, which is pretty cool. Lastly, we have Brad Pitt, who was in Cutting Class in 1989, Thelma and Louise in 91, Johnny Suede in 91, Cool World 92, A River Runs Through It in 92, and I guess he might be working. I haven't checked.
He kind of disappeared. I don't know.
It's written by Michael Graves and Mark Victor, who wrote the original Poltergeist.
Oh, boy. Yeah. You know, you hear all these names and titles, and... Man, I wonder how often they talk about this movie.
That's the crazy thing about some of these. I mean, this is one of the more mainstream 90s films that I've talked about, but like, it's amazing that people go from all these different projects that are moving all the same time in Hollywood, you know, and then you would get to this and be like, wait, the guy from Vanishing Point also worked on Cool World? Like, all right, I wonder if anyone, or if you, sometimes you'll ask people and they just won't want to talk about it too.
Yeah, I mean, I have a few of those on my resume.
Yeah, so. Sure. Some fun notes before we get through it. This was pitched as a hard R animated action film. Once Kim was attached, she and the studio were uncomfortable and they softened it to what they thought would be a PG rating, which I think is what we're having a problem with with Cool World. It ended up being PG-13 because it's Bakshi's version of PG is still filthy. He was almost fired and sued after punching the producer in the face when he was told they're changing the movie.
Well, I did not know that part, but yeah. That doesn't surprise me based on what I heard.
And Kim's character, Holly, was originally called Debbie Does Dallas, straight up after the porno character Debbie Does Dallas.
I've never seen that one either.
It's pretty wild. The film starts in 1945, and we see a crowd waiting for soldiers returning. And we see Brad Pitt. He does the signature Brad Pitt point, even in this movie. He takes his mom on a motorcycle ride. We see some drunk people. Nothing good's going to come from this. They wreck. Brad Pitt has a flashback, and his mom's dead. So enjoy the movie, kids. We've started off by killing a mom already. I mean, you have that in Bambi and so many animated features. Why are so many animated movies started with the death of a parent?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'll give Bambi some leeway for it. In this movie, I have no idea.
It doesn't make sense. The mom plays no care. Like, they just kill her for no reason.
I mean, within 5 minutes of watching this movie, I had no idea what was going on.
Yes.
And it doesn't improve from there.
No, it took me two times, which is rough.
Well, it works. My spike works.
There's a cartoon scientist all of a sudden that opens a portal and Brad Pitt enters the Toon World. We meet the Doodles. They say,
"You've come to a whole new world. You've done something extremely rare. You see, you're in a real place called the Cool World."
Which, I mean, if you're playing along, you have to take a drink, because they said the name of the movie in the movie.
"You're cartoons. You're not real."
We get our glimpse how Brad deals with mental instability, and then boom, it's 1992. We know this because Ministry New World Order is playing.
Yes, it is.
We get Gabriel Byrne drawing porn in prison.
"You're just a drawing, Holly, but without you, I'd never have made it."
And, I mean, there's no real reason we should beat around the bush here. Why is any animated film or comic book film, why is it always about someone wanting to have sex with their drawings?
Well, I don't know. I mean, sometimes I used to think I had a crush on Mrs. Brisby from Secret of Nim.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe it is a cartoonist thing.
I don't know. You're right. Maybe it's just a human thing.
Yeah.
Of course,
she wasn't my creation, so.
Right.
I got no leeway there.
It's like if Dr. Frankenstein wanted to have sex with Frankenstein.
That would have been an interesting movie. There's a twist we didn't see coming.
I know. I saw the movie Frankenhooker, but that's a totally different thing. He gets sucked into the cool world, and we don't know why. He lands in a horny wolf club that's playing Thrill Kill Cult. Kim is dancing around, and everyone wants to have sex with her. And the set is really interesting. There's like multiple painted set pieces. And this is how they got Kim in the movie. They didn't even show her a script. She saw these giant set pieces, and she said, I want to be in that movie.
Yeah.
And then she read the script and was like, I can't do this. Oh, man. Brad shows up to see Kim. He's a cop, which means he's apparently made it through the academy. I don't know how it works in cartoon world, but...
Rumor has it, Holly, that you had annoyed visitation at the Slash Club last night.
It was just a mind slip. Nothing special.
He says that she was visited by annoyed, which is what they're calling humans. We're annoyeds, which is weird. She expresses that she wants to be real and get out of tune. I mean, sorry, cool world. Back, she has great set dressings, and there's just random animation that happens in this movie. Like, it's not forwarding the story. There's just like a crazy sequence with a cartoon cannon at this point. It's so bizarre.
It's like every scene in the movie is incoherent and kind of fries your eyeballs. So the movie never has any time to breathe. It's sort of every scene, it's like a hammer comes out of the TV and just punches you in the balls with it. It's maddening. It distracts from what the scene is even trying to tell you, because suddenly there's a giant floating head in front. It's just kind of mystifying. Just a bad acid trip.
At the time of this recording, you people can stream it on Amazon. I'm not sure how you saw it.
How did I see it?
You own it?
I think it was on Amazon. I think we rented it.
Okay. Did it look good? Because on my TV, it looked pretty mushy. Like,
no, it's very dark.
Yeah. Okay, great. So that was...
So perfect, really.
Yeah, got a little
movie
less.
And you can't see it.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah.
Stay cool, man.
We get Gabriel Byrne's release from prison set to the music of Enigma, which anytime I hear Enigma, I just think of, do you remember in the 90s? Oh, I don't know where you were at in the 90s, but we had this store in the mall called Natural Wonders that sold like crystals and like Zen posters and things. Not important, but it basically, that's what I always think of when I hear Enigma. It's like the music that professors would have sex to. He sits down to draw and then opts to go to a comic book shop. And in the comic book shop, one lady recognizes him.
My God, it's you, isn't it? You're Jack Deebs, the creator of Cool World, right?
Oh my God, I can't believe this.
Do you have any idea what kind of an inspiration your work is to people?
No,
I mean, I know people, friends of mine, who want to be Hollywood when they grow up.
Really?
Yeah.
And so he just starts signing comic books and things that haven't even been purchased yet. Like, I saw it, I was like, I think you have to buy those first. Like, you can't just write on stuff. I don't know. It was very weird. What we don't see in the beginning is sort of where he got his start. So I know that you started with The Land Before Time, but where did your first interest come from for even drawing?
I was always drawing. Mm. So my older brother was a fantastic artist as well, so... Whenever I saw him drawing, I would just sort of sit down and start copying him. But I was obsessed with dinosaurs when I was younger. So all I did was draw dinosaurs all the time. Every scrap of paper, there was just these dinosaurs all over the place. I mean, I'm still kind of obsessed with dinosaurs now, but I draw them less. So,
yeah. I'm trying to think of if any of your art I saw online is dinosaur oriented. I think there's one.
I can't think off the top of my head, but I'd be surprised if there isn't something in there.
Yeah. Well, the one piece that you did, the one I'm going to get for my daughter, the Secret of the Howl.
Yeah.
That piece, I would watch an entire movie off that. I don't know what the storyline would be, but I love the design on that.
Well, I tell you what, Dirk, if you have $100 million, we'll make the movie together.
Okay.
And it might even be as good as Cool World.
Okay. I'll check my bank account. Okay. Might be a little shy. For no reason, he's sucked back into Cool World.
All I need is a 4 and I win.
We see a bunny playing craps with some goons and they roll the dice, and one of the goons has a really long nail, and it's just a very confusing scene, and I didn't know why we're watching these people or what this has to do with anything. They threaten her with violence and prostitution, which is a sex slave joke in a kids movie. So that's where I wrote, who's this film for?
I was sort of excited to see how you were going to deal with the synopsis.
Yeah, that's good.
I gotta be honest.
Okay. Gabriel enters the Cool World set to more Thrill Kill Cult music. He's taunted by all the creations. It's very oddly sexual. Every person that interacts with each other are grabbing each other and groping, and it's very disturbing. Kim shows up and she's smoking and pounding liquor.
Welcome to my world, big man.
Am I dreaming?
Well, am I dreaming you?
So again, I was like, they thought this would be a PG film? Like, what part of this movie, if you cut all of, I mean, it's so frustrating. She says she's dreaming, am I dreaming of you, or are you dreaming of me? And then she honks his undercarriage. She just straight up grabs his dick. And it's just like, what? This film is so crazy. So if you were sucked into one of your films and had to have sex with one of those characters, no, I'm just kidding. I won't do that. they are dinosaurs, but they're children. So you'd have to go with like the 18th sequel, because I think they're still sequelizing.
I think there's about 400 sequels, one of which I've worked on, thankfully. So no, I mean, I really like dinosaurs. I've never really thought about having sex with one, least of all a cartoon one.
But well, in the situation, you would have to be a dinosaur, too.
Yeah, I guess so. there's not a lot of choices.
Well, legally, there's just Littlefoot's mom, I think.
Yeah, and she's already in trouble by the end of that movie. I don't...
That's true. That's one I should probably rewatch as well. There's another show we could pitch called Dino Milfs. There you go. I think we could get some money on that.
Yeah.
Then the cops show up. Cue the song Sex on Wheels as a very incoherent car chase ensues. A baby urinates on police officers, which
that's
is...
That's right.
Yeah.
For that part.
It's one of the highlights of the film, I'd say. Brad Pitt questions a streetwalker.
I got a couple of questions for you, miss.
Oh, come on, officer. Let it slide, would you? I'm tired.
Word is you got a thing for Noids.
And gets news that Gabe Burns is there, so he sets off to find him. Cue more crazy rave music, because we've got Moby's Next is the E blaring for no reason. Like, the soundtrack is so crazy in this movie. It's nonstop. Like you said, it's just a cavalcade. Like, it's just an onslaught of everything all the time in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's that quintessential 90s soundtrack, too, isn't it? I mean, all these movies in the 90s... definitely the audience they were going for, they always had kind of the same culprits showing up on the soundtrack.
Yeah, it's at least refreshing that they didn't do the mashup thing that was so popular in the 90s, where they're like, we're going to have rappers and metal bands make songs for Judgment Night soundtrack, you know?
Yeah, and the soundtrack was the best part of that movie, too. Yeah,
that's true. That's very true. I wonder if there's any jobs in Judgment Night. I should look into that.
And around here, everything goes. Everything except one thing.
Yeah, what?
What's that?
Noids do not have sex with doodles. Right? Noids do not have sex with doodles.
We get the one rule. Noids don't have sex with doodles, in case we didn't know by this point in the film that that's what this whole movie was about. And it is, as we'll get to that. I wrote here... I already probably asked you this, but what's going on?
I'm amazed your synopsis is going on as long as it is, because I mean, I couldn't keep track of what happened in this movie, and it was just jumping all over the place.
Yeah.
Gabriel Byrne was in and out of the real world.
Yeah.
Brad Pitt's never explained.
No.
I mean, it's astounding to me that it has two scriptwriters, because I just don't know what must have happened.
I think there's a game, I forget what it's called, but where you write two sentences and then you fold the paper over the first sentence and the next person can only read the exposed sentence, and then they write two sentences and then you fold it over, and there's, and I think that's what they must have done.
I feel like the script fell in the shredder and yes, they just, you know, put it back together from there.
Yeah, it's so crazy. There's a weird, Brad returns home to his girlfriend. He has a girlfriend in this scene, which I didn't remember till the second viewing. And it's this weird blue ball situation where she says,
"Well, why?"
"Because we can never finish it, Lonette. You know, it's frustrating. I'm like a plug without a socket, you know?"
Where I was like, this, what? These guys wrote Poltergeist and they just wrote, "I'm a plug without a socket."
"Hey, Frank."
"Hey, what?"
"Did you ever do it in the real world?"
She asks if you could go back to the real world so you could have an orgasm. These are the major plot points of Cool World, in case anyone's wondering. Gabriel Byrne gets sucked back into the cartoon world. I don't understand the logic between this back and forth that's happening. Brad encounters a door that he can't get in, so he climbs the building. Nails, the guy with the really long nails, climbs the building with Brad Pitt hanging from his body. It's so weird. Brad enters a party smoking a cigarette, which you don't often see in kids' movies.
"Well, hello, Harris. Welcome to the party."
"And what a swell party it is."
He meets Kim and she says, "Where's the Noid?" Oh, she wants to be real. That's what's happening at this part. My notes start getting really dodgy and we'll get to why in a second. Kim taunts him with her booty. A rabbit family is at the dinner table. She says a man is on the building and the kids get super stoked. It's so weird. This whole episode is mostly just me saying it's so weird, but it is so weird. The next sequence is just cartoons trying to witness sex. Like, now, I don't know what the notes were for this, but that is super crazy. Then Kim becomes real. Kim gets ratted out. Gabriel is creepy, and here's what I meant. My next note literally says, "These cans of wine are tricky. I was drinking so much to get through this movie that some of my notes," this is the only time this has ever happened on the podcast, "become completely incoherent."
Well, you're doing better than me. I did try to start keeping notes while I was watching it, and I really did give up about 20 minutes in, because, you know, there are some common problems with a movie like this. Animated features like this are notoriously expensive to make. And they're usually given their release date before anything is even drawn. So the problem becomes, if the script isn't in good shape, and this has happened with a lot of the movies I worked on, it happened quite a lot with the Bluth movies too, where you had a script that wasn't really finished, but you also had a release date that had to be met. So you had to start working on this movie, even though it's probably not where it needs to be to finish it. And I'm going to assume it's something like Cool World, that once you've created some of the animation for the movie, that's going in there. There's no taking it back. So all the only parts of the movie you can still work on with the script are the parts that haven't been animated yet. So if you haven't got everything in place before you start, this is kind of what happens. It just runs out of control, and it's impossible then to curl back into any kind of shape.
Yeah. Oh, that makes sense. That happened to Bakshi with Wizards. That's why there's whole battle sequences where it's just the characters going through plain white screen, because they just ran out of money and time, and he was just like, "This is what it's going to be." Which is crazy, because then people are all like, "It's a stylistic choice or whatever," and you're like, "No, it's money and time."
Well, I mean, these movies take, you know, 18 months to 2 years to make. So And you're burning through a lot of money while you're doing that. You're paying artists, you're paying actors, you're all the other aspects of the production that need to go in. And of course, this thing is live action too. Just because you can animate and just because you can direct animation doesn't mean that that's going to translate to live action as well. So I can look at something like Cool World and I can admire the size of Bakshi's proverbial balls to take on a project like this, because it's huge. It's a huge project. Even just directing either a live action or an animated movie separately is such a huge endeavor. But to try and merge the two genres, even just on a technical basis, to try and merge animation with live action actors is, I mean, it's just a phenomenally huge undertaking. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised that this is the equivalent of just 90 minutes of falling down the stairs.
Yeah.
But it's just a shame that it just couldn't be pulled off properly.
Yeah. I wish that we could have seen the original, like the real Bakshi version of Cool World. Because yeah, that thing that's frustrating to me is you feel the constricting hands on it to like try to push it into the shape of something like a Roger Rabbit or something, when it's this dirty, grimy underbelly, you know, it's not the Roger Rabbit. It's not entertaining. It's, but like his earlier films that were really, you know, rough, tons of just drug abuse and craziness like that, they were exploring that world. And instead we don't get really any exploring in Cool World. We're like on these tight rails, there's a bunch of crap thrown at you, and then you're just kind of like, ugh.
I was amazed that it's a Paramount movie. I'd completely forgotten that it was a big budget, big studio movie. So yeah, when I saw the Paramount logo come up at the start and the names of the producers, you realize that there's a giant studio with its reputation at stake,
yeah,
funding this thing. So yeah, I agree. It would have been much more entertaining, I think, if yeah, Bakshi had just somehow managed to do this through independent means and just made the movie that he wanted to make.
Yeah.
But you're right, it's a phenomenally non-entertaining movie because, like you say, it was probably pitched as a hard R.
Yeah.
It ended up being pitched as being turned into a PG. So you're trying to make something that caters to everybody and ends up catering to nobody.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really bat shit crazy. With your schedule working on a huge show like Family Guy, do you have, like, does it work seasonally with animation? I mean, how does that? It does.
Yeah, we got like 20, 22 episodes a season, and it's a pipeline. So, you know, for instance, right now I'm working on maybe 3-4 different episodes at the same time, all in different stages of production. So, you know, In a perfect world, when the script is written, I will design characters so that the director who will direct to the episode in question will essentially have his cast to work with when he and his team of storyboard artists, you know, map out the episode. But because the schedule is so tight and because there are so many episodes and so many other factors that come into play, you don't always get to supply him with everything he needs, because the shows that are coming close to the end and need to be prepared to send overseas to be fully animated, that's going to grab your attention then too. So there's a lot of spinning plates.
Mm-hmm.
You're sort of jumping from one episode to the other, but it's pretty fast moving. You know, compared to what something like working on Cool World would have been, it's a pretty different medium. It's a completely different pace.
Yeah. So overseas, is that where they do that position we talked about earlier, where you're filling in between the two, the man with the cup on the table and taking a drink?
I mean, it's hard to compare the two mediums because they're so different, but on something like Cool World, an animator will have full freedom to work from storyboards and interpret the scene as they see fit. So if the storyboard is Kim Basinger's character walking into the room, the animator will pretty much have as much freedom as he wants to sort of present that in any way he wants. On Family Guy, our storyboards are actually very detailed. So what we do on Family Guy is essentially all the pre-production. So we will, the scripts are written here, the designs are all done here. The each episode is storyboarded in excruciating detail. Mm-hmm. And that entire package will then be sent overseas to an animation studio who will unpack all this, but will, through the storyboards and the designs and all the other various departments, they'll know exactly what to do with it. But they won't really have any freedom in terms of interpreting.
Got it.
Griffin walks into the room. This thing is mapped out very tightly on the storyboards. Yeah. How he walks in, what speed he walks in, what he does. So,
right.
Yeah.
Whereas it's something like Cool World, the animator would draw, like, you know, Kim walking into the room, and she could do like a little sachet or something, or that would some little flourish that they're like, I threw that in there, that's like my signature or something.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting talking to Paul this morning because he actually animated most of the Kim Basinger work, which is probably the highlight of it in terms of the animation, mm-hmm. in terms of the,
it's the least
technical end of the animation. Yeah. It looks the best, it looks mm-hmm. the most solid. Now, I had initially thought that she moved so well and so smoothly, I'd initially thought that she had been rotoscoped, which yep. in animation, you know, as you know, in animation terms, they film an actress or an actor live action, and then they give those printouts to the animator and say, like this,
yeah.
draw over this, make sure the action's the same.
That's how they did Fire and Ice, I think.
Yes, and a huge chunk of Lord of the Rings, too.
Yeah.
And because it's cost effective, it saves time. But it can end up looking a little stiff. It always looks like you're tracing a movement. But Paul was telling me today that by accident, he animated one of the scenes of Kim Basinger's character. He had been assigned something else, but the Kim Basinger part was in there too. And he assumed that he was supposed to do it too. And he didn't use any of the rotoscope. And I guess Bakshi saw it and fucking loved it. And then from that point on, Paul was in charge of all the female human animations. So, and it definitely stands out in the movie because even for an animated movie that's trying to show a huge range of animation styles, it's such a mishmash. It's so jarring to watch it. It doesn't fit together at all.
Yeah. So,
my brain just felt bruised after watching
it.
I'm not even saying that to kind of bag on it. I know how much work goes into these movies.
Yeah,
I know how many long nights and sore hands and just, you know, even a bad movie like this, a lot of people put a lot of good work into it. So,
well, that's what I mean, like mentioning, like you said, budget and time. Because maybe that floating head or whatever character that's not as fleshed out as Holly, you know, it's just like you have to get it done. It's not like up to your best work or whatever. It's just like they say you have to do this, you have to do it. You're like, but this is what it's going to look like. And they're like, yeah, keep moving. Like, we can't lose money in this, you know?
Yeah,
see, I just talked to a special effects guy and he was kind of saying the same thing. You know, it's like, for him, he's like working on the gags, the gore gags and everything ahead of time so that there's no chance that someone will undercut you on time or something because you've worked it out to a T, but you can't really do that when you're drawing something and there's already a release date, you know?
No. It's an interesting challenge because I've been doing this so long now and I really do think, you know, my techniques and my work ethics are all down to nothing but conditioning. It's, you know, I always seem to, the worst thing that could happen is I get a deadline of a year. Sometimes somebody comes and says, hey, you know, sometimes somebody hits you up and says, hey, I've got this great idea for something. Would you be interested in doing it? And you think, oh, that sounds great. When do you need it by? And he goes, you know, February next year. And you think, oh, this is fucking awesome. Yes, absolutely. I'll do it. I have a whole year to do it. Fucking great. But it's always 2 weeks before it's due.
Yes.
And I haven't done shit on it. And then they call up and go, hey, how's it going? And then it's like, oh, fuck. So then you got to cancel your life. But I'm sure for every artist has their own way of working. And I don't think my way is a good way of working because all it does is create stress. And, you know, you're like roaring at people, like, get out, I have to do this. But it's really the only way that kind of works for me. When you're working on something like Family Guy or Cool World, you can only do the best work you can in the time you have.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a big, important lesson to learn as a cartoonist. It's almost as important as being able to draw well. The deadlines are such an important part of it. There's no point being the greatest artist in the building if it's always late or if you're missing deadlines, because it just clogs the system up. You have to be able to keep going. And Family Guy's deadlines are so different than working in feature animation. I worked in DreamWorks for a while, and it was fantastic. I was working with some of the greatest artists I'd ever worked with, some of these French dudes that, you know, stuff they were thrown in their trash, you'd be picking while they weren't looking so you could take it home and just marvel at it. But, you know, DreamWorks, they were all about the quality. So sometimes they would say, dude, we don't care if you do 3 drawings a day, just make them the best drawings they can be. Now, that's great, but even being told that in the back of your mind, you're kind of, I don't know what sort of way this is to run a business, you know. So as a result, these movies end up costing, you know, $150 million.
Yeah.
And they don't do that kind of business at the box office. So Family Guy is very different in that regard.
Yeah. So since you do it in seasons, when you have breaks, is it like, do you have like a 2 months off, or is there like any kind of downtime, or are you constantly working on like the next season?
I'm constantly working on it because we just seem to roll over. I'm on Family Guy 16 years this summer, and I've never had a break besides vacation.
So any other projects that would come your way would just be added to the pile of work?
It's pretty tough. It's pretty tough to juggle the work stuff with the personal stuff.
Yeah.
And of course, the work stuff, you're so conditioned with a safety net because there's a huge approvals process in any of these, you know, projects, Cool World, Family Guy, whatever. There's always going to be somebody above you that you have to show your work to, and they'll look at it and go, you know, that's not how you draw a thumb, or, you know. But
even for you after 16 years?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
like, you draw something and be like, that's not how I draw Glenn Danzig.
But yeah, that's not what Tom Cruise looks like. it never really relents. You never really get to the point where you think, oh, I have this figured out. That just may mean I'm shit. I don't know. It's
you know, no,
that's a possibility.
Standard, I think. Going back to me being too drunk for this movie, my next note just says Brad O. Saxophone. Brad O. Saxophone. So great. There's another flashback, and then Kim is writing with Jack, and she says she wants the spike of power.
What?
The spike could heal me. Vegas Finney put the spike at the top of the casino.
You're nuts.
And then she turns real. Brad tries to stop her. They run up a staircase. He almost dies. She starts flashing from toon form to real form. So it kind of looks like rotoscope or something in this one scene. She then kicks him in the junk. He flies through a wall. She turns into a toon and then walks through a wall. It's very strange. She climbs a building. He gets sent to his death. Did that happen in the movie?
I don't know what happens at this point.
Oh my God.
So anyway, she climbs up and pulls something that triggers the release of terrible ghosts. Okay, I don't even know if I was still watching the movie at this point. I wrote, it's a lot of everything and probably too much. That's probably a very accurate note at this point of the film. And then Brad's dead. So that happens. And he becomes a doodle. And what's her first question? Can we do it?
So did you do it while you were back there in the real world? Did you do it while you were real?
Because this movie's that horny that the second he just died and crossed over into Toontown, which is not how anyone else got there. Nobody else has died. They've all just passed back and forth through some magic wormhole. It's so crazy. And then that's what kids are left with. Their cartoon characters are going to go have sex. So, oh, man.
Yeah, I mean, I'm exhausted after even listening to you.
Yeah.
The movie.
Me too. So is my wife. The movie ends with David Bowie music, which is so strange. And that's the end of a very frustrated film.
Have you ever been stuck in traffic with your daughter and she's telling you a story and she's just making it up each sentence at a time? So, you know, the girl says this.
Yeah.
And then your daughter, you know, you can tell she's thinking about it while she's making the story up, but obviously there's no cohesive sense to any of it. And that's just kind of what this movie is like.
Yes.
When Kim Basinger is at the end and she wants the spike of power, I mean, to my memory, there's not even a mention of any of this at any other point in the movie.
It's crazy. They're just like, well, there's the spike of power. And I was like, wait, come again? What?
Yeah. There's a whole lot of, wait, what?
Yeah. It's so weird. And then at the end where they're just like, and Brad Pitt's dead, but now he's a cartoon. And you're like, that's not how this cartoon world works at all. Like, so these are all ghosts? This is a ghost world? It's not even a cartoon world? Like Gabriel Byrne is drawing people's ghosts? Like, what is this?
I mean, none of it's really clearly explained. Like you say, we don't really know the context of Gabriel Byrne's character, but even by the time he's in Toon World, and it's not even made clear that he wants to have sex with her. I mean, none of it makes a lick of fucking sense.
Yeah, and originally it was Brad Pitt was going to play the Gabriel Byrne character, but the studio said that he didn't have enough star power. So they put Gabriel Byrne in, which is another thing that just doesn't make sense at this time. It's pre-Usual Suspects. It's like, what? He'd been in Miller's Crossing. Nope. Nobody that would watch Cool World saw Miller's Crossing.
I wonder if it's one of those pieces of casting where they literally just went down the list of, here's the people we'd like, and then eventually they get to poor old Gabriel and say, hey, dude, do you want it? And I'm sure Gabriel thought, well, you know, a paycheck's a paycheck.
Yeah, I mean, it's a major studio, you know? It would look great for him and Brad at that point.
Yeah, I also wonder, you know, how this movie was pitched. I'm sure as a pitch, it was probably pretty interesting. I'm sure as an actor, you thought, you know, Who Framed Roger Rabbit had come out.
But gritty and great.
It was a huge hit, and it looked great. And I suppose all these people thought, oh, fucking cool, we're going to do, like, an adult version of that. And, I mean, I don't know. I know we bag on actors a lot, and rightly so, because, you know, they deserve it. But I'm sure there's plenty of times where they're attracted to a project, they sign the contract, and then they're handed the script, and then they go, oh, fuck.
Yeah, or there's, like, rewrites or any, because, like, once they've signed on to the project, that's, you know, then you get they're like, oh, there's a revision in the script and now this happens, and then you're naked in a river or whatever, and you're like, oh, I didn't sign on to do that. And they're like, well,
tough shit.
Yeah, that's what's happening. Pretty boy, get in the river. Any final thoughts for Cool World?
I was kind of excited to talk about it, but honestly, the more I think about it now, it just kind of makes me angry. I didn't enjoy watching it at all. It's not even a movie that's so bad it's entertaining. And you know, the fact that it's so confusing and just hyperactive and incoherent doesn't really do it any favors. It just ends up kind of aggravating you, because every moment of the movie is just screaming out of your TV. And you're just exhausted by the end. I just wanted to go to bed after. It was just, I mean, it was just fucking exhausting.
Yeah.
So
I think that's why I was drinking my canned wine so quickly, because I was just like, this is so hard. Like, something's got to bring some joy to this.
Yeah, that's the pisser, I think. It wasn't a fun watch. No. It really felt like a project. Like, oh, I have to finish this. Even Kaya, who watched it with me, was kind of, you know, we don't have to finish it tonight. We can, you know, we can watch the second half of it tomorrow. And I was like, no, I can't. I know I won't go back to it tomorrow. Like, we're doing it all tonight, or we're not doing it at all.
And I did have one episode where the guest told me it took them 3 times to get through a movie. I was like, oh my gosh, like they just kept starting it and stopping it. And I was like, I didn't mean it to be that painful, but that's the real deal with Cool World.
Yeah. I mean, it got worse for us because we stuck on Rockadoodle after it, which also has a segment of live action mixed with animation. But the live action is also directed by Bluth himself, an animation director, and it just doesn't translate. And
that's about a musician chicken, is that right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that one's a hot fucking mess, too. But it's, you know, but at least you can follow it.
Yes.
I mean, it's horrible, and it doesn't really make any sense either. But at least, you know, at least the story goes from A to B. I couldn't make any sense of Cool World. When you were talking about Brad Pitt and his mom on the motorcycle.
Yeah.
I mean, at that point, you realize you're just on your own. No one's going to help you. No one's going to help you.
No.
Just left to fucking drown.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's so interesting having your insight because it's not a fun movie to watch or revisit. But the empathy piece of you understanding the process and the things that can go into these sort of these big pictures and things, it does help a little bit because then I feel like I don't know, what's the word? I don't feel bad for the people that were involved in it, but I feel like maybe they weren't able to shine in their most possible abilities. You know, I feel like the restraints, the constraints and the rewrites and the reshaping of the script by two writers, I mean, and who knows who else came on board.
Oh, I'm sure there's tons of uncredited stuff there too.
Yes.
But you should feel bad for them, Dirk. I mean, you should, honestly, because, you know, they're as frustrated as we are watching this movie, you know, except that they actually helped create it.
Right.
Think about carrying that cross on your
back. Oh, for like 18 months of their life they spent on there.
Yeah.
You know, where they're like, I could have been doing anything else.
And I've worked on movies like that, you know, where, oh, cool, at least I've got work for the next 2 years. And then you read the script and go, geez, okay.
Oh, boy.
You know, and again, it's not intentional. I guess that's the part I think I'm a little more sympathetic to now at this age. Whereas when I was younger, I would have just fucking raged at something like that. But I think at this age, you can sort of see nobody intended for it to be this much of a mess.
Yeah.
And the animators who work on it, I mean, there's some nice looking stuff in there. I mean, some of those backgrounds with those kind of wavy skyscraper stuff, I mean, some of those backgrounds were fucking awesome looking. I mean, they just belong in a better movie. It's a shame. You can tell there's a bunch of people busting their balls to do the best work they can, trying to stay inspired. You know, they're doing their bit. It's just let down by the people in charge. So,
yeah.
Just unfortunate.
Well, now we can move on to the final questions. Are there any common misconceptions about your profession?
I think the biggest misconception is that one person does fucking everything.
Yeah.
So for Family Guy, that's Seth MacFarlane, does the voices, writes the scripts, does the drawings. But, and it's the biggest misconception I'm always happiest to shatter when people come in for a tour of the studio and they realize that, oh, fuck, there's like 150 fucking people here all doing a very specific job. I mean, it's a huge amount of talent and personalities and people to just try and shape into something. I mean, at feature anime at the Bluth studio in Dublin on Land Before Time, we'd like 400 people in that building.
Wow.
So I think that's probably the biggest misconception people have about animation in general. It's just like, oh, you know, one person fucking does it, big deal. So
yeah, that's what I encountered with the special effects guest as well, is just the difference between like just the different names of positions, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we just mentioned one, but I saw so many, I couldn't write them all down, but I was like, there's so many different positions working in, you know, working this one, you know, character or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. It does a huge amount of coordination. And collaboration. And I think personality is just as important as talent too. Mm. I mean, you got to have a bunch of people who can all get along with each other, breathe the same air and figure it out, because I've worked on projects where, you know, everyone fucking hated each other's guts. And, you know, at least once a week you'd hear somebody explode on the other side of the floor. And there were good times looking back on it. I hated every second of working there at the time, but as soon as it was over, I was sad because, you know, I missed the drama.
Mm-hmm. I could see that. What is a good day like for you?
A good day? You know, I gotta be honest, they're all pretty good days. You know, Family Guy's been a great run. It's a great bunch of people. So, and I like the show. It suits my sensibilities. So I'm very happy there. Even on a bad day, it's never that bad.
That's the next question. What's a bad day like?
A bad day is, you know, tight deadlines, unreasonable amounts of work expected in unreasonable amounts of time. That's probably the worst one. I mean, I'm in Los Angeles, so you can always add the commute onto that part. It's, you know, it's not directly involved with the job, but it kind of is, because some mornings you just walk into the building and you're already fucking raging. It's just sitting down and drawing cartoons isn't exactly what you want to do. You want to go with an axe and just start taking people out. That's a bad day.
that sounds pretty awful. What are your favorite things?
My favorite things?
Involving?
Motorhead. Dinosaurs. Judge Dredd. Anything Mad Max related. This pandemic isn't quite as entertaining as I thought the end of the world would be.
I know, none of us are wearing shoulder pads and have bohawks.
No, although I've got the assless chaps, so that's but I didn't expect that I'd be bored during the apocalypse, but alas, here we are. They're probably my favorite things. They're the things I think about all the time.
Yeah. That's pretty good. Dinosaur and Motorhead.
Yeah.
Are there any artists that you could think of that you particularly enjoy the work of?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm not one of those artists that gets inspired by seeing people who can do things way better than me. You know, my Instagram's all full of artist feeds. And honestly, I find it kind of depressing and demoralizing when I just look at people who can do shit that I can't. It's like, fuck this. And I know some people look at that shit and they run to their drawing desk to try and copy it, but I can't do that. So I'm not even going to try. I'm actually more inspired by seeing artists who are worse than me. So at least I can look at it and go, well, I'm not that fucking bad. And that I find, I'm not even fucking kidding. I find that more inspiring, I think. That's the thing that gets me to go, well, this turned out okay. And it's better than that other piece of shit I'm looking at here. So, I mean, I don't know. That's like a little victory. But
yeah. And the Instagram's Metal Mongrel. That's where you post stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I should probably get better posting stuff, I guess.
Yeah, I got really slow when suddenly life gave me the most time. I was just instantly was just like, nah, I just won't do anything with that. I don't know why that is.
Yeah, it turns out having all the spare time to do all those projects and finish all that stuff I wanted to do, it turns out having spare time wasn't the problem at all. So.
No, I always think about that before. Like when I did social work, my wife did social work, and then there was time when we weren't doing social work. And I would watch like 5 hours of TV or something. And then she started a business and I started working with her on top of my job and then starting like other projects and things. And all of a sudden you're like, I did 47 things today. And I used to do like one. It's like you can always fit things in. It doesn't seem possible in a day. And then having no framework for it, I'm just like, I just lay on the floor on my face, I guess, for hours.
That's kind of where I'm at. Kai is definitely dealing with this better than I am. I'm kind of crawling the walls with it. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger has this quote about how people waste so much time. Because he's like, even if you have a spare hour in the day, I'm not going to do an Arnold Schwarzenegger impression, by the way. I'm just going to say, though. But but he's kind of, oh, if you have a spare hour in the day, you could be doing something. You could be reading a book. You could be working out. You could be doing something. But, you know. What's he talking about?
Yeah. And plus, he's got a team of people to kind of move him around and do stuff. Like, I have a friend who works on the Late Late Show with James Corden, and he said that, you know, Tom Cruise comes in, and he's got, like, a flurry of people that, like, you know, put a carrot in his mouth or whatever, just, like, at certain points of the day, you know, give him a snack and keep him moving. And it's like, yeah, if you have a team of people, but, like, I'll eat like a human being, and then the second my wife's not home, my meal is like a tortilla with mustard on it or something.
Though, I feel like Tom Cruise probably needs a flurry of people.
Yes.
I don't look at that guy and think he's got anything figured out. He probably needs to be told when to eat. I mean,
yeah.
He'd probably just sit on the couch and starve without someone to tell him.
That would be weird if it was like, yeah, it turns out people couldn't get to his house because of the virus, and he just starved on his couch. Like, no one fed him a carrot. That was the end. Turns out the mission was quite possible.
Yeah.
Oh, I just lost you on the screen, but...
Can you still hear me?
I can still hear you. Still recording, so we should be
fine.
There it is. Do you have any advice for somebody who's interested in getting into animation?
I would say to,
is it a profession where there's like an apprenticeship? Like, does it work to reach out to people? And
it always helps to reach out to people, but in terms of an apprenticeship, no, not so much. You know, when I got hired straight out of school, it very much felt like an apprenticeship. There were all these ex-Disney artists. I mean, my first day on the job, you were handed a production scene and you were told, okay, you're working on it. And then you did one drawing, you brought it to a guy who would essentially tell you everything you had done wrong, and then you would go back and try and fix it. But it was a great learning curve, and you learned fast, and it was a nice environment. It's very different now. I mean, they really do expect you to hit the ground running. So I would say reaching out to people is definitely a really important part of it. Reach out, try and make connections, just try and get in the door any way you can. You know, we've had some of the best artists on Family Guy, some of them got in just working as PAs just to try and get their feet in the door. So it's like, oh, great, I'm buying lunch for the writers. This isn't exactly what I had in mind. But it's enough to get in and then make your interest known. So I think any way you can get in is a good way to get in.
Yeah.
But also, you know, be passionate. And I think just try not to be too precious with your work. I think that's the hardest lesson for anybody. You know, as artists and as kids, if you've been drawing since you were a kid, you know, it is quite a precious thing to you. You enjoy the time, you enjoy the work you create. So it is tough to go into an environment where somebody goes, no, that's not how you draw it. This is how you draw it. Mm-hmm. Or in the case of Family Guy, you know, the show is so script driven. The script is the king on Family Guy. It's all about the jokes. And we're really there to service that script and to try and make the gags as effective as we can. But, you know, stuff gets thrown out all the time. Stuff gets rewritten, you know. You can apply a lot of work that if the gag doesn't work, it's gone. And there's no point. There's just no point being attached to it. You sort of have to learn how to cut the umbilical and just accept that this isn't my show. I'm just doing it for other people.
Yeah. Well, and you, you know, have your own, I assume, style that you like to work in, but then being a character designer, your job involves looking at something that, like, Seth drew, is that correct?
Initially? Sometimes he'll provide a sketch.
I mean, like, for just who started he did the initial characters, right?
Oh, yes. Sorry.
So, like,
yes.
You have to look at that, and then you have to create things in line with, like, you can't draw, like, a super badass dragon. It's gotta have the round gumball eyes and, like, you know, fit in with that world. So it's kind of an interesting skill set, because if they are unhappy with something that you did, it could be just not fitting into that world or something, because it's not like they're insulting. Are they insulting your work, so to speak, or?
No, I don't think so. I mean, you're right. I mean, when you work on any of these shows, you have to be adaptable. You have to accept that. Well, look, my chosen style would not be Family Guy. Let's face it, three heads tall with ping pong ball eyes. It's true. But if you're willing to go with it, there's a lot of interest and challenges in that too. I mean, we were just bagging on Tom Cruise, but if you're given Tom Cruise to design for the show, it's not as simple as just doing a caricature of a celebrity. I mean, like you say, it has to fit into the parameters of the show. So not just that it looks like Tom Cruise, but it also has to look like Family Guy. So there's some interesting choices to be made. I mean, I'm still quite excited by it sometimes. So it's a nice thing to say after a run like this. It's easy to get burned out. Projects I worked on for like 6 weeks and I was ready to flush myself down the toilet after. So it's nice to be still fired up to work for somewhere.
Yeah, for sure. This is the final question, and it's my favorite question.
Oh no.
Yeah. Mick, what are your dreams like?
Well, the last dream I had, I dreamed that I was at a Metallica show and they invited me up on stage to headbang with them. And the stage was only like 6 feet wide, so there's no room for anybody. And I tripped over the drum kit and wrecked everything.
Oh, no.
But that was the last dream I can remember. Most of them aren't usually that much fun.
Speaking of Metallica, on your website, there is two different huge Metallica, were they posters? What were they?
Yeah, I got to do the official Slane Castle Metallica show last June. They sell these screen prints at the show, and they usually, you know, there's all these fucking badass, kick-ass artists that supply these prints, and I managed to track down the email address of the guy in charge of it. And Slane Castle is in Ireland, and it's about 40 miles outside Dublin, a big open air venue. It's like fucking like the most beautiful place you've ever been. And every year they have a huge big concert there, and Metallica got announced for it. So I tracked this guy down and just salted his email. I was like, yeah, look, you know, I'm in Los Angeles, but I'm Irish. And, you know, like, come on, please, please. And it was sort of disappointingly easy. He was like, oh, sure, okay. And I did the print. And then I flew to Ireland for 4 days to go to the show.
Wow.
And I just drank my fucking head off the whole 4 days. And I gotta tell you, you know, I don't know if there's a weirder feeling than standing in a field full of 80,000 drunk Irish people and seeing your artwork displayed at the side of Metallica's stage. But I gotta tell you, that was a pretty weird but fantastic moment.
Were you listening to Motorhead or Metallica when you were drawing it?
Probably both.
Okay.
Both. I'm a Metallica apologist, man. I know they get put through the ringer by people, and maybe rightly so in a lot of cases, but I don't know, man. They're still rocking it for me, so it's...
Yeah. My good friend growing up, his older brother was like the perfect age for Metallica. We were like a little younger, I think, for like, you know, Kill 'Em All era stuff.
Yeah.
And so we had firsthand seats to just an amazing badass period, I think, for Metallica.
And that was pretty awesome. That's my, you know, the first albums leading up to the Black Album or whatever are, I think they're pretty untouchable, I think. I don't know.
Oh, I think so, too. And, you know, yeah, it gets a little patchy after that. But, you know, they're always a good time live. And honestly, yeah, I'll accept that I was floating on a wave of pure narcissism in June. But, you know, it was a pretty amazing show. It really was. I mean, everyone just having a real good time, the band included. And, that's what it's all about. I mean, back when we could all, you know, hang out with other people.
Right.
Remember that?
Did you tell anybody that you're like, that's my artwork?
I didn't, but my best friend was telling everybody around us. And that was kind of, yeah, I mean, that part was kind of embarrassing because I don't think anybody believed it either. So that's fine. But Yeah, that was a good time.
Yeah, that's awesome. That is a fantastic story to have at the end. Well, Mick, I can't thank you enough for this. Thank you for enduring the film Cool World.
Dirk, I was more than happy. And this was a really good time. And the next time you do find another really bad movie about animators, I'm more than happy to take up the challenge again.
Okay, well, it won't be Monkey Bones, so just know that that's...
that's good news, because I don't know if I could do that one either.
All right, thanks again.
All the best, man. Thank you.